Good morning. May it please the court. The most significant legal issue that the trial court had on her plate was whether the court should suppress the November 9th statement that Christopher Collins gave at Muncie Bridge and the subsequent statements later that day. To that end, the court held a suppression hearing. That hearing spanned 6 days, 1,400 pages of transcript. State called 11 witnesses, the defense called 3. But despite all the evidence that the court heard, it refused to consider one of the most crucial pieces of evidence. It refused to consider a videotape of a conversation between Chief Clark and Christopher Collins on November 14th. That videotape was crucial because it showed firsthand and very clearly the true nature of the relationship between the two men and the tactics that Chief Clark used to get information from Christopher Collins. The
argument reminds me of those cases where you have some kind of auto accident and they want to get into evidence the fact that someone was driving recklessly sometime after the accident as evidence of what occurred at the time of the accident. And isn't that the basis of the court excluding the evidence that it occurred after the fact, and that isn't evidence of what occurred at the time of their conversations prior to the conviction or to the confession?
Well, Judge, nothing would have changed in the interim. It's more similar to, say, people finding out that the defendant had some mental health issues after the fact. The same conditions would have been there at the time of the initial statement, even though it's discovered later. I think the situation is more akin to this, because somebody could be driving recklessly on one day and fine on the next. But this, we're talking about the nature of the relationship between these two men, and really nothing would have changed that.
Other than the fact he would have confessed to a crime.
He had already confessed.
Right, and so is there not the potential that that confession changed the nature of their conversation?
If anything, Your Honor, I would think that it would have made his dealings with Christopher Collins, he'd have less of an incentive to be pressuring. He was under more pressure with the November 9th statements to get a break in the case, to be able to make some arrests. And when he's not being videotaped, the November 14th information that he was trying to get out from Christopher Collins was regarding another potential defendant, but he was being videotaped, so one would think you'd be more careful while you're being videotaped than when you're alone with a suspect. This videotape was directly relevant to challenge Clark's credibility and the testimony that he gave during the suppression hearing, especially with 4 points, whether he pressured Collins, whether Clark had safeguarded Collins' constitutional rights, whether Clark treated Collins differently from other members of the community, and whether Clark had made promises. With regard to pressuring, at the suppression hearing, Chief Clark said repeatedly, "No, I never exerted any pressure. This was a completely voluntary statement." Well, when you look at his November 14th statement, I hope you watch the video because it's really shocking at the amount of pressure he exerts to get information while all the time saying, "Now, I would never pressure you. I'm not pressuring you, but," he says, "I'm not going to pressure you or force you or anything, but there's just some details and some things about that I'd like to clear up." Later he says, "Like I said, I'm not going to put you under any pressure or anything, but Chris, I really wish that some of the details that are conflicting in this, if you so desire, if you would clear that up, and maybe I could get a good night's sleep and put some things at ease." later, I wouldn't even dream of pressuring or coercing you into saying or doing anything that you didn't want to do. And if, as you read the context of those 33 pages of transcript, it's just constant pressure.
Isn't that what they do?
Yes, but...
Isn't that what they do to get a confession?
Well, the thing that's so shocking about in this case is that Christopher Collings has told him, I have a lawyer and I don't want to talk to you. He tells Clark 9 times that he has a lawyer and as upon advice of his lawyer, he's not going to talk
on the
14th. About this case. On the 14th.
Okay. We're talking about the 9th.
Well, these...
This is only relevant if we want to draw an inference from what happened on the 14th that the same thing happened on the 9th, right?
Well, it shows the nature of their dealings. And
well,
it's
only if we infer that the same sort of conduct occurred on the 9th.
Well, if you have Chief Clark is saying, I would never exert any pressure on you. And then you see him saying, I would never exert any pressure on you in the 14th.
So what pressure is he asserting?
He's constantly saying, even though Collings has said, I'm not talking to you. Clark just keeps pushing it and pushing it and pushing it, despite the fact that he has counsel, and he knows he has counsel.
So it goes to credibility.
It goes to credibility.
And isn't that a determination for the trial court that we don't substitute our judgment for the trial court?
Yes, if the court has considered all the evidence. What the court wouldn't even consider this videotape from the 14th. And so when the court eventually comes up with credibility findings, it's not a valid factual finding. And although normally we would defer to the court's factual findings, in this case, because the court didn't consider all the evidence relating to credibility that it should have, this court should not defer to that finding.
The standard of review in reviewing the admission of evidence is abuse of discretion, is that right?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. One of the things that I wanted to mention regarding...
What was the offer of proof in this case?
The offer of proof was the videotape. The court viewed it, but then the court said, I am not going to consider it for purposes of this proceeding.
Why doesn't that answer the question? In other words, I don't think it's relevant. I sustain the objection. I've reviewed it, and now I'm sure that it isn't relevant. I'm sure that it doesn't affect my ruling.
But that's not, I don't think that's what she...
It doesn't mean I didn't consider it. It means why doesn't it mean I have considered it, and it doesn't change my mind because of when it occurred?
She wouldn't even admit the offer. She wouldn't consider the offer of proof as to the voluntary nature of the statement. And she believed that as a matter of law, she could not consider it.
But where does she say that, as a matter of law? She said it's refused for the purpose of the offer to attack the defendant's prior statements to the chief made on the 9th. It does not operate to invalidate the defendant's voluntary statements. And I understand your interpretation, but couldn't the court's comment be interpreted to mean, having looked at it, the court didn't feel it affected credibility and therefore wasn't on the earlier date and therefore wasn't going to consider it further? That's why he was rejecting it, not that he thought he was not allowed to consider it.
Well, I believe what happened was initially the court at the end of the suppression hearing said, I will not consider it. At the beginning of her finding, she said, I did not consider it. And then at the end of the finding said, I cannot consider it. And
why could she not consider it in her view? What is your...
Because she believed, as a matter of law, that that the totality of circumstances only operates to determine if the defendant was in custody. She said it is used to determine if the defendant was in custody for the purpose of whether a defendant should be Mirandized at the time of making the statement. Mm-hmm. The totality of circumstances considered for the purpose of determining whether a suspect is in custody does not operate to invalidate prior statements of the defendant. So she believed that this totality of the circumstances was applicable in that other context, but not in the context here. And she's saying that she's refusing it for the purpose of the offer of proof to attack the statements, but the purpose of the offer of proof was a credibility determination, and she never considered that as towards the actual purpose for which it was supposed to be.
Now, she's a trier of fact, because it's a suppression hearing. She's seen the videotape. Does she then basically say, I'm not going to consider that, it's out of my mind?
I believe so. I believe that she believed that it does not, what the state was arguing, I think she bought the state's argument at the suppression hearing, was that it could not wrap back around, in the state's words, that the November 14th statement could not be used to invalidate the November 9th statement.
Well, in looking at the voluntariness of this November 9th conversation, it was the defendant who initiated the contact with Clark. And the defendant had the ability to leave the area by the bridge at any point. He wasn't in any kind of custodial, it wasn't like in a locked room, so he was free to leave. The length of time wasn't unreasonable. And isn't your case also hurt by the fact of maybe the relationship between the defendant and the police chief, because they had a friendship before, as opposed to he was being asked questions by a law enforcement officer who he had never known before?
No, I actually think that the relationship makes it much worse. And there's several cases that I cite in my brief about the false friend tactic, which is a tactic that police officers use to lure somebody into a false sense of
even though
comfort.
The defendant initiated the contact and all the other previous contacts?
Well, I think the more important contacts are on the 7th and the 9th, okay? On the 9th, Collings goes to Clark. Well, they actually sort of find each other while they're... Collings had been followed all over town all morning by somebody in a van. He lost him for a while, but then the person was following him again. And Clark had been talking to him earlier in the week about there being talk in the cafe. It could get bad with vigilante justice. There's feelings in the community against whoever did this. And Collings was really afraid about what was going on with this van. And because he had such a close relationship with Clark, he went to Clark. Clark was somebody who he went to when he had problems, mm-hmm. when he needed advice, when he needed comfort. Mm-hmm. And he was an advisor. He was a protector in a way. And he went to Clark to help make his problems go away. And he was scared, so he went to Clark. He didn't go to Clark so that he could confess. He went to Clark to see who was following him, if it was a police officer or not. And Clark, and as you see him do in the November 14th videotape, Collings goes to him for one purpose, and it soon morphs into something else that is...
But again, he was free to leave, and he chose not to. Maybe he just wanted to get it off his chest.
Maybe he did, but he hadn't done it all week. He had held off all week until he had this fear about what was going on with the van.
But your position, I don't think, is that you can't, if you're a friend with the defendant, you can't talk to him or the confession's invalid.
No.
You're saying he improperly implied he wouldn't protect him unless he confessed? Does it all depend on that argument?
There's multiple aspects to this. We have the aspect that Clark is very good friends with Collings, has been for 17 years, sort of a father figure to him. And the state, the police exploited that relationship.
But I mean, is that improper? Are they not permitted to do that, to have someone who the defendant feels comfortable with talk to them?
If it was by itself, it wouldn't be necessarily. But when you have Clark telling Collings, here's your constitutional rights, but you really, it's in your best interest to talk to me instead, that's not true. And
don't they often do that? I mean, I'll go easy on you. It'll go easier on you if you tell me your story. I think that happens a lot, doesn't it?
That happens. And the situation here, though, is that because he is a friend, because they have this relationship, the line gets blurred about, are you actually talking to a friend or are you talking to a police officer? And so the voluntary and knowing nature of the statement, of whether you're giving incriminating evidence to a friend, your advisor, versus somebody who's then going to turn right around and call the FBI. The state has the burden of showing that the statement was knowing and voluntary.
How many times had he been Mirandized prior to the 9th?
He had gotten a modified version when he took a polygraph. He had gotten a Miranda in the context of a CVSA, he had been Mirandized on Wednesday when he was very upset and came in to talk to Clark. And at some point, he was Mirandized on that Friday.
And there's a disagreement as to whether he got Mirandized before or after they spoke. But Mr. Clark said that he Mirandized him before they spoke. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And then there's a question about the 3 p.m. written on the,
right.
on the statement mm-hmm. that indicates it might have been after.
Yes. So
there's really no dispute that he was Mirandized. I mean, at least the trial court's findings, which there was evidence to support, is that there is no dispute that he was Mirandized every time that he was in custodial interrogation, and assuming that this incident wasn't even custodial, that he was Mirandized then gratuitously.
If he was Mirandized once on Wednesday, he was Mirandized at some point on Friday. Yes.
And you agree this whole issue is not preserved. So you're asking for clear error, plain error.
The issue about whether the court abused discretion in not considering the November 14th is not preserved. Otherwise, the suppression issue is fully preserved.
Okay, well, let's be a little more precise. The claim of error is that it was excluded, correct?
Right.
Because not considering might mean not giving it enough weight. Your claim is that the trial judge erred by excluding it from evidence.
Correct.
I thought, having read the transcript, that the proffer was made that the videotaped testimony should be used to infer that the police officer acted the same way on the 9th as he did on the videotape, that he engaged in the conduct you described as overbearing his will and pressuring. That's what I understood the proffer to be, and then I thought that's what you were answering my question in the affirmative earlier, and then you told Judge Breckenridge that it was proffered for the credibility of the police officer.
Well,
so which was it?
I guess I'm not understanding. It was offered so that the court could consider whether Clark was credible when he says things like, I didn't pressure him at all. And the court can see in a similar situation that Clark is, in fact, exerting undue pressure, and that Clark himself might not even understand that he's doing this, but it is being done. And that does, I guess it's a second part perhaps, is that should be considered as to whether it was voluntary.
What happens to him if Clark doesn't talk to him? I mean, if he doesn't go to Clark, what if he says, I got a lawyer, don't want to talk to you? What happens to the whole videotape interview?
Would you repeat that, Your Honor? I'm sorry.
What happens if Collings says, I got a lawyer, I don't want to talk to you? period. What can Clark do to him? What pressure can Clark, what consequences happen? That's what pressure would be. What consequences would happen to Cullings if he said, "No, I got a lawyer. I don't want to talk to you."
In the November 14th?
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, that was excluded, right? Because he asked for counsel, yet Clark kept talking to him, so that's excluded.
Everyone agreed that he had violated Cullings' rights in the November 14th. If Clark had respected Cullings' rights during that November 14th, conversation would have ended. I guess I don't understand what you're talking
about.
Well,
if Cullings had said, "I don't want to talk to you, I have a lawyer," period. What happens to the videotape? There's no videotape then, is there? Clark can't do anything to him.
Right. Yeah. I mean, then I
assert my rights. It was read to me. I have a lawyer. I don't want to talk to you.
Yeah. I mean, you'd still have the fact that he's trying to talk to Cullings, knowing that Cullings is represented by
counsel. But doesn't that end the conversation?
Yeah. I mean, then there wouldn't be much to compare.
You're saying in this case, though, he did not honor his assertion of his rights. He continued to talk to him, despite the fact that he had asserted his rights.
But he nine times asserted his rights, so that's why it was excluded. That's not an issue. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Right. Well, my concern is, what about the inference that since the interrogator knows that this tape is not likely to be admissible, Does that affect the analysis at all? In other words, if the interrogator knows because he's avoided or went past what the interrogator knows is the rules, what he knows the consequence of that is that this tape will not come in as evidence, regardless of what is said, right? And in fact, it didn't come in.
True, so, but that doesn't excuse anything.
I'm not saying it does, but is that a factor that the trial court could have considered as to whether or not the conduct would have been the same on a different day? In other words, if I know nothing I get's coming in, am I going to act the same as if I got to act knowing that this evidence either will or will not come in?
Well, I think the primary thing on Clark's mind was not whether this would come into evidence, but he's saying, "I want this information, and I'm going to get it from Cullings. I know I can manipulate him. I know the buttons to push, and I'm going to do it."
And maybe I don't disagree with that, but does that mean the information that I'm acting different because the information is more important to me than whether or not I'll be able to use the information at a later trial? Does that affect the way I act as an interrogator? And is that a reasonable inference that a trial court could take?
That because he looks ahead
Well, it's not looking ahead. He's already made the incriminating statements on the 9th, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the incriminating statements were made on the 9th.
Okay.
Then on the 14th, he's asserted his rights, which means whatever he says is not likely to come into evidence.
Right. But and I'm sorry if I'm not following you, Judge, but it's Clark's behavior, it's the fact that Clark is using these same techniques that defense counsel is trying to show that he used the first time around.
No, I understand, and maybe I'm not articulating well. What I'm saying is, that's an inference that could be drawn. That's an inference that you're suggesting could be drawn. Is an equally persuasive inference that could be drawn is that this information is more important to me than the fact that it could later be used at a trial.
Are you talking about Cullings or Clark?
Talking about Clark, just like you are.
Okay, I'm just wondering.
Well, you're suggesting that he knowingly violated his constitutional rights. Mm-hmm. And that the trial judge should assume that because he knowingly violated his constitutional rights 5 days later, that he should draw an inference that he knowingly violated his constitutional rights the 5 days before when the incriminating statements were taken. Mm-hmm. And my question is
Well, is there an equal inference that could be taken that if the officer did, as you suggest, knowingly violate his constitutional rights and know that it wasn't coming into evidence, regardless of what the person said, is there an inference that he might have even pushed harder, knowing that whatever he got wasn't coming in?
Well,
and I'm not saying it's right, but I'm saying, is that a legitimate inference for the trial court to accept?
I don't think it is, because the information at that point that he wants to get is our leads against David Spears. And so whether or not he violated Collings' rights, the information he wanted was against Spears and could lead to other avenues or something that he could confront Spears with. As I said earlier, I believe that if anything, he was probably being more careful because he was on videotape and he was under less pressure to make a break in the case. And I'm well beyond my time, so thank you.
Any further questions? You'll have time on rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court, I'd like to start right there because I obviously the state believes that is exactly the most likely inference going here. The state is not pursuing, Chief Clark's not pursuing evidence against Christopher Collings at this point. They have all the evidence they need to convict Christopher Collings based on Christopher Collings' statements on the 9th. On the 14th, they're trying to make their case against David Spears. But David Spears has given a statement. David Spears has provided information that seems to suggest that David Spears is involved in this murder. But Christopher Collings has said something completely contrary, and the state wants to make sure that they pursue all the killers here. There's either Chief Clark is the worst police officer around, or there was never any intent to use this evidence against Christopher Collings. And that's what I think the most court could reasonably conclude. Of course he's going to behave much differently, not the same, but much differently on the 14th when he's interviewing Collings than on the 9th. At the 9th, they don't have a case against Christopher Collings yet. So of course they're going to fully make sure that he's aware of his rights. They're going to make sure to not make any suggestion that they've pressured him. They're letting him control the environment of the interrogation. They're letting him make the contacts. No police officer contacts Collings from between Wednesday night, when Collings voluntarily came in to see Chief Clark on his own accord, until Collings hunts around town calling, trying to find Chief Clark on Friday morning, and they finally meet up at appellant's assistance. The testimony that Chief Clark gives shows that they were very respective of making sure that Collings gave a clean statement on the 9th. On the 14th, they didn't need that one.
Now, how is Collings in control? Sure, he sought out the interview, but it's at the police station, isn't it, where the videotape is, and Clark is in charge of the interrogation. How is Collings in charge?
Oh, no, not at the 14th. No, Collings has been arrested at the time. Well, actually, on the 14th, Collings was the one who initiated that contact as well. Right. Collings wanted to speak to Clark, so that's why Clark comes to speak to him. But on the 9th, it's Collings who seeks out Clark. It's Collings who says, where are you? And the chief says, well, I'm at your place. I've been looking for you because I hear you're looking for me. It's Collings who says, stay there. I'll come there to meet up with you. It's Collings who chooses to get in the police car. They go to the police station. It's then Collings who says, I don't want to make my statement here. I don't want to talk here. I can't talk here. There's too many people here. And Chief Clark says, where do you want to go? And Collings says, let's go out to Muncie Bridge, a place that Collings had hung out before. Appellant is not handcuffed during any time. Even though he tries, he says, you're going to cuff me. I don't need to cuff you. We're not doing that yet. You're not in custody. And then when they get there, Chief Clark says, well, do you want me to ask you questions or you just want to tell me what happened in your own words? He said, I'll tell you what happened in my own words. It's appellant who's dictating how his statement is being made at Muncie Bridge. And that's the statement we're talking about, the one out the bridge. They're not in a police-dominated circumstance. It's appellant who's controlling it. In fact, Chief Clark says, the other officer says, we're on our way. And he says, no, we're just going to go talk. You stay away. it's as non-custodial as a statement could be made on the situation as the Ninth. It's as unthreatening as any situation where somebody's going to confess to murder.
But the point is that that's the prosecution's theory of the case.
Right.
The defense wants to assert in their theory of the case that there was pressure asserted by Clark, and that evidence of that pressure is his demeanor as exhibited on the 14th. So the question becomes, what legally keeps out that subsequent conduct to support the inference that the defense wants to put forward to the finder of fact, which is the judge in this case? In other words, subsequent repairs in an injury case are not admissible to demonstrate that the condition was dangerous at the time. Okay, what legal precedent keeps out this inference that the defense wants to bring in at this point in time?
Okay. As we say in our brief, I don't necessarily know that what the trial court was saying here is, I refuse to consider this evidence on this issue. And its findings of fact exclusive clause, it doesn't seem to say that.
No, it does, because it takes the offer of proof and then says,
right.
Yeah, I've seen the offer of proof, but I'm still not going to consider it.
I don't know that it's what it says is that it rejects it for the purpose that it was offered, that it doesn't operate to nullify the voluntariness of the confessional knife. I think what the court is saying is, I don't find it to be probative to that issue, and if it's not probative, it's not relevant.
Was the tape offered into evidence?
Was the
videotape 14th? Of the 14th offered into evidence?
Yes, during the suppression hearing.
Did the court receive it into evidence?
Yes.
Okay.
Or I'll put it, at least the court viewed it. It accepted it as part of the offer proof.
Well,
that's
was
different.
It marked
that
as
is
an
different.
Exhibit?
And yeah, that's what I meant to say. I'm sorry.
Was it marked as an exhibit?
Yes, I believe it was.
And then somebody has to offer it into evidence.
Right.
And then either the court accepts it into evidence or refuses to accept it.
Initially, the court's ruling was that it would not be admitted into evidence.
Okay.
Appellant offered it then as part of an offer of proof.
Okay.
The court said, I will view it as part of your offer of proof. The ruling on the offer of proof was held out until the findings of facts and conclusions law. So the paragraph that we have explaining the court's ruling on the offer of proof is what we have. Now, yes, I say maybe what the court is saying is that although I find it vitally probative, I don't believe I legally can consider it.
And did the state take that position below, that legally the court was not permitted to consider it? Or did the state take the position it was not relevant to the issue?
I believe it shouldn't. That the state's position was it shouldn't be admissible because it's not relevant. Mm-hmm. Not that it's that, despite the fact that it might be relevant, that it's otherwise inadmissible. I don't know what other theory
there is. Are you arguing on appeal it would have been error for the court to admit it?
Actually, no. I don't know that. Other than is it relevant? No, I don't necessarily know that the state's relevance argument to exclude it was necessarily the best argument to make, and that the court absolutely couldn't consider it.
The ruling is a matter within the trial court's discretion,
right,
generally in determining the legal relevance of evidence.
Right. I don't know that the legal. I don't know that. Again, we're talking about a suppression hearing, so I think the court can entertain a lot of evidence, can sift through and figure out what it thinks is relevant, what's not relevant. I think the final effect of what the court did in issuing its finding facts and conclusions of law, though, is saying, I viewed the tape, I just don't find it relevant. So if this court believed that what the court was saying is, I'm making an evidentiary ruling and refusing to consider in my mind the relevance, I think what we would do is remand to the trial court, have the court say, consider the evidence and re-rule on the motion to suppress based on consideration of the 14th. And what the trial court would say is, I still don't find it relevant. So even though I now consider it and admit it into evidence, I don't find that it changes my mind. Because you don't have to make the leap that appellant insists you must make. That if the appellant, if Chief Clark acted a certain way on the 14th, if Chief Clark didn't ignored the Sixth Amendment, which wouldn't have been relevant on the 9th, but seemingly ignored the Fifth Amendment as well during the 14th, that he necessarily did on the 9th. And that has to be what appellant has to establish here, that it necessarily meant that on the 9th that he violated his rights, because this is a plain error case and it must be outcome determinative. You must find that the 14th is such compelling evidence that Chief Clark was lying when testifying. It's not just the state's theory of what happened on the 9th. It's Chief Clark's testimony, which the trial court found credible. It said, no, based on the 14th, the court erred as a matter of law in finding Chief Clark credible in what he said on the 9th, and that you must find that he violated his rights on the 9th. And that's, there can't be law.
I'm not so sure why it's a plain error, given that there was an offer of proof made, and there was an attempt to have the court consider.
It wasn't included in the motion for new trial.
Okay.
So,
all right.
We think the court considered it on its merits and found it irrelevant. And that's a different case than saying, I'm precluded from even thinking that it could be relevant. Regardless, it's not so overbearingly relevant that it would have made a change in the court's rulings. On the issue of Miranda, yes, there was conflicting evidence as to when Miranda was administered, whether prior to or after Munsbridge. The court heard that evidence. The court heard that Chief Clark said it happened before. It heard that appellant claimed it happened after. It saw the Miranda waiver form, which I do believe was either the second or the third full Miranda waiver form that appellant had seen.
And is your position the time on the Miranda waiver was incorrect? Because all the other evidence supports that 3 o'clock could not have been before.
Right, right. And so, yeah, and that's what Chief Clark says. Well, I didn't check the time when he wrote it down. It was appellant who wrote the time down, not me. Nobody checked, was appellant wearing a watch that said that? There was evidence presented that, no, that time is incorrect because I gave it to him before. When Chief Clark did his report about it, he referred to the form. He didn't refer to his call log, which is what they used later to figure out the exact time.
Chief Clark knows the impact of videotape versus a statement at the bridge or wherever, and he's doing this videotape. It's almost like the Siebert case, which we had about the Supreme Court, where you know what you have. I mean, he had the ability to organize this videotape, to put Miranda on there and not put Miranda on there. It's his videotape. He could have, but he did it the way he did it.
Well, the videotape statements later weren't even Chief Clark who did those. Appellant was taken up to Berry County Sheriff's Department for the videotaping, which was actually the third time appellant went through. He confessed Chief Clark out at Muncie Bridge. Then they came back. He was warned. Now, with that said, just because there's two different statements and there's warnings after second doesn't mean we're talking about a cyber situation, because there is no evidence that there was some intention to, well, I'm gonna get him to talk to me without telling him that he has rights, and then I'm gonna come back and then give him rights. That's the only time cyber is applicable. Otherwise, else that is still controlling law. And here we don't have the evidence because Chief Clark insists I read him his rights before we went out to the. Before we went out to the bridge. So the only evidence the court found credible was Chief Clark's testimony. The court heard the explanations for why the time was wrong on the form and credited that. It did not find appellant's testimony credible. Those are explicit findings, and as the court has already said this morning, this court defers to those findings. The court was wrong as a matter of law for finding that Chief Clark was credible. Chief Clark's testimony alone establishes that appellant was advised of his rights prior to the statement. Now, as to the issue of voluntariness, we set out a brief going through the steps that prior precedents of this court have shown, say, here are all the factors that show why a statement is voluntariness. Much of appellant's argument on coercion looks at things that are completely outside of appellant's scope of knowledge, completely outside of knowledge. She says, look at the police. The police are getting together to talk about how Chief Clark should talk to him because Chief Clark cussed him and are coordinating their talks. But appellant doesn't know anything about that. That can't render the conversations between appellant and Chief Clark by themselves involuntary. The issue is what appellant knows, what is being communicated to appellant. Does Chief Clark really have the only appellant's interest of keeping him out of trouble? No, he doesn't. We know that. Chief Clark is trying to get a confession of this case. Well, that does not nullify the issue of whether appellant was voluntary in making his statement. According to what the testimony that the court found credible at the at the suppression hearing, there was sufficient evidence from which the court could reasonably conclude that appellant's statement was voluntary. First, as we've already talked about, appellant went out of his way. It wasn't just somebody calling and saying, Chief Clark saying, hey, could you come talk to me? Sure, come talk. That would be voluntary. This is beyond that. This is appellant on Monday, the 5th, flags down the chief while they're out on the roads to tell him that he's assisting in crime. Already we see appellant who's trying to engage in some manipulation, trying to use a police officer that he knows to put efforts to put the focus off him. On Tuesday, 11-6, he comes into Chief Clark's office uninvited, unannounced, on his own initiative. On Wednesday, he comes into Chief Clark's office unannounced, unannounced. And on Friday, he goes through great efforts to try to find Chief Clark, and in fact, finally does hook up. All of those were initiated by appellant. They were not. That suggests that appellant wants to engage in conversations with Chief Clark. Second, there are elements of the record that show that appellant actually wanted to confess to Chief Clark. During his recorded interview, appellant said that he badly wanted to tell Clark about the murder as early as Monday. So even when he's flagging him down and trying to mislead him, he's like, man, there was a part of me that just really wanted to tell you that of what had happened here. He said the crime had been eating at him. He said it was in my mind to tell you before we met up on 11-9. All of those things are things that the trial court could look at and said, looks like he really wanted to tell Chief Clark about this, that it wasn't just that his conscience was overborne by some improper persuasion. We have the things that Chief Clark said. Now, appellant goes on a lot about this 11-14 statements and this pressure that was being put on. But as the court commented, there's nothing wrong with a police officer appealing to a person's conscience and trying to say, come on, you've got to tell me what's going on here. Come and tell me. You've got to tell me. What improper coercion is are things that resemble promises or threats to improperly compel a statement. And none of that happened here. There was this false friend concept with the Spano case. What happened there is that the police made up a situation where they were convincing a defendant that something bad was going to happen unless appellant testified to this other guy. They created a false, they used a friend of the defendant to create this false situation where defendant thinks, I'll confess, not because I want to confess, but because some unrelated harm is going to happen. Here that wasn't it. There was at no point, there was no falsity going on here. Chief Clark, yes, is a friend, but as the court has already said, there is no constitutional prohibition that requires police officers to act with conflict of interest rules. That if a police officer has an established friendship with a suspect, that he said, well, I can't interview him. And that's essentially what Appellant is arguing today, that it's just improper for an officer friend to talk to an officer suspect. And that's just not constitutional, a constitutional problem. Here, what we have is we have Clark always holding himself out as a police officer. There's nothing to suggest that that Clark was acting only as a friend, only in appellant's best interest, that he ever communicated that to appellant. What he suggests to appellant is, you've got to tell me this because we have to solve this crime. You've got to tell me this because we've got to find this little girl. We have to find out what happened. He's always talking about what has to happen as part of the investigation. And more importantly, appellant always understood he was talking to Chief Clark as a police officer, not as just a friend who's going to help get me out of this. He twice holds out his arms in front of himself, like, I need you to arrest me. He knows that when Clark says, well, that we may have to do that at some point, but we don't have to do that yet. And what appellant says, well, for what I'm about to tell you, you will. He knows he's confessing a crime to a police officer. He does not think he's just confiding in a friend who's going to not get him in any trouble for this. Because he understood that Clark was acting as law enforcement, because Clark never suggested he was operating as anything other than law enforcement, this is not a case of subterfuge where the state is pretending that Chief Clark is just a friend and not a police officer. There's two statements the appellant seems to rely on to suggest that Clark did this, that Clark was actually threatening something or somehow compelling it. This first was the statement where Chief Clark said, I told him I would stay with him all the way through this part of it, but he had to tell me what happened to the victim. Appellant suggests that somehow this was this was him saying, I'm not going to protect you from danger, I'm not going to protect you from harm unless you tell me. That's not what's going on here. This is not Chief Clark's case. The case, the crime did not happen in the city limits of Wheaton. Chief Clark has no official authority to be investigating the case. And to be honest, they found the body. If they find evidence that connects appellant to the body, it's not Chief Clark who's going to be coming and arresting appellant. It's going to be Barry County officials or Newton County officials or FBI or whoever's going to wind up doing it. It's not going to be Chief Clark. If basically what appellant is saying here, or Chief Clark is saying to appellant, is that if you want me to stay involved in this case, you got to talk to me. And that's absolutely true. There was nothing false about it. Plus, what Chief Clark was saying is I'm gonna walk with you through this as much as I can. And Chief Clark did that. Chief Clark was there with the Muncie, let appellant handle how he's going to tell the Muncie Bridge conversation. Chief Clark let him ride back in the car with him, let him smoke in the car, even though he didn't let anybody do that. Stayed with him for the statement at the Wheaton Police Department. Stayed with him at the first interview at Barry County. Came back after Barry County started interviewing him a second time. According to the court's finding of facts and conclusions of law, Chief Clark actually appeared with appellant, stood near appellant at his arraignment. And then on the 14th, Chief Clark came back again because appellant asked him to come to talk to him. Chief Clark did exactly what Chief Clark says. I'm going to walk with you through this process if you confide in me. And that's what he did. There's no false, there's no deception, and there's no promise of anything other than assistance with telling his story. There's also this statement where Chief Clark says, look, I can't protect you 24 hours of the day. There's nothing false about that. There's no idea that you have to say, you have to tell me what happened or people are going to kill you. He didn't make any threat like that. It's not even an implicit threat like that. But more importantly, the cases that are out there on this, and we cite one of them, I believe the Payne case, all the cases that we see where there's this threat of mob violence or there's this threat of vigilante justice have to have that kind of quid pro quo. So, well, there's a mob out there who wants to kill you, and by golly, I think that's going to happen unless you talk to us. And only if you talk to us can we do anything about it. We don't have that circumstance here. These two isolated statements are the only things that Pellin points out that could possibly arise to the level of improper pressure. Other than that, it's just the kinds of pressure that Chief Clark allegedly used. Were those directed at the appellant's conscience? Were those directed out of let's find this little girl, let's get this thing solved? Those are the kind of things that I think we not only recognize the police do, but encourage police to do. We want people to confess to crimes as long as we don't unconstitutionally coerce them through false threats or false promises, or true threats or promises for that matter. None of that happened here. This statement was voluntary, and we most of all can see that through the fact that appellant was pretty capable of not being coerced into saying anything that he didn't want to say. He was 32 years old. This is not a young age or extremely old age, which would be apt to have his will overborne. He had a normal IQ. Appellant had not confessed earlier. He'd been interviewed by other policemen. He'd been through the CV, the voice stress analysis and the polygraph, and he hadn't confessed those times. And in fact, when he said, I don't want to talk to you anymore, I'm not going to talk to you anymore, police said, okay. And they stopped the conversations. He knew he could get out of conversation he didn't want to be in.
I hate to interrupt you, but could I get you to talk about, I think it's point four on the admissions of the evidence.
Okay.
Particularly the hair comparison testimony.
Mm-hmm.
Was this a failure to preserve it in the motion for new trial? Was it objected to?
The hair comparison was. I thought the hair comparison was preserved and the DNA wasn't.
Okay. And how about the string and the ashes?
Those were preserved.
Okay. Would you mind addressing those?
Sure.
Of hair?
As to the string first, the easiest one is the burn stove remnants. The appellant said he burned something in the burn stove. They got the ashes out of the burn stove. They took them evidence. They didn't find anything of evidentiary value, but it showed what they had done. It showed part of the nature of the investigation. That's admissible.
And so there wasn't any mischaracterization or misuse of those ashes?
No. In fact, appellant doesn't even argue that. Appellant's only argument for that one is that it was irrelevant. As to the string, the state's position is that it was a string.
That's what the witnesses called it.
Yeah, the witnesses said it looked like a string, it looked like cord. When it was tested, and understand, it was the state who put on the witness who said, well, it was strands of fiberglass. By the time he invested, by the time he did the testing, it was dry as a fiberglass. One, you have to assume that that rope or twine or string can't be made out of fiberglass. I think that there's strings out there in the world made by that. We've put a couple photos in. I don't know that they're exactly the same one, but there's several photos in now in evidence of string and twine all around this place. Appellant said he choked her with string or twine. There was evidence that there was string or twine or rope or cord or whatever this stuff was at the scene. The police found everything that they could find to get it. Nobody ever said that this was the murder weapon. Nobody ever. The state never hinted at that. In fact, the state kind of went along with Mr. I think it was Gerhardt.
Which seems to make it totally irrelevant then, but questionably prejudicial.
Well, I think it makes it questionably relevant, but totally non-prejudicial, because if the state says, well, it's not the murder weapon, but it's something we found at the scene. Again, appellant was objecting to everything. The chain of custody testimony in this case is
fine. Well, if it's not the murder weapon, it has no relevance then.
If it's not the murder, well, it's relevant because the nature of the police investigation, what evidence that they were running, was relevant. The state had reason to believe that appellant was going to contest the quality of the investigation. Well, there was things that looked like string at the scene, and you didn't seize that, did you? That's a cross-examination that come from Hollowmouth, unless the state actually tested everything. And so for the state to explain, here's what we did in the investigation, is relatively probative. And because the state never insinuates that it's the murder weapon, there's nothing prejudicial at all about it. Add to that fact that appellant never denied committing the murder and committing it by use of the cord or burning up the murder weapon. Even their theory at trial was that that didn't happen.
So how about the hair comparison?
I'm sorry, let me get this. On the hair comparison, again, and I think this goes hand in hand with our partial DNA profiles. The hair comparison, yes, she said, I can't tell you it's his hair. I can't tell you it's so consistent that it's probably his hair. What she said is if you compare them, they do appear to be similar in style. That's relevant.
How is that relevant?
It has some relevance because there's a hair.
But the jury's going to assume it must be him then since it was similar?
The question is, does it probate the prejudicial value because on the shoes it outweighed the probative effect?
Well, no, it's not. I don't think the prejudicial value is that it might not be his hair. I think because the probative value, like, it might be his hair.
You're saying there's not evidence there was someone else there, or?
Well, what I'm saying is that it is some evidence that if it's similar to appellant's hairs, and she, I mean, this wasn't just, well, I don't know, it's a hair and it looks similar to other hair. It was pretty detailed comparison, microscopic comparisons. The microscopic slides are, well, at least pictures from them are before the court in these exhibits.
Well, isn't the question whether it was scientifically valid comparison? Because in the scientific community, you can't use that type of hair to make the comparison.
What she said is you could not use that type of hair to make. And she said an association, which I think she was using as a term of art, to be a match. She says, right. I can't tell you it's a match. Right. I can tell you it's similar.
That then makes it have no scientific validity.
Because she didn't. What she said is it does have some limited comparative value. She did say that you can't make a comparison. If she had said you can't make any comparison that has any meaning, that would be true.
Scientifically, is it acceptable in the scientific community that a comparison of those hairs has scientific value?
Well, I believe that her testimony said it had limited value.
What is the value other than to have the jury conclude it must be his, which you can't scientifically do? What relevant scientific value did it have?
Well, I don't agree that it was one that it must. Two, that it might, and that it could be, and the reasonable inference is that it was. I think that is a legitimate, reasonable inference to raise from evidence showing that this hair is similar to his hairs. The only reason they couldn't make a match was because of the type of hair, but she didn't say you couldn't compare the type of hairs and find them to be similar, so that they may have come from the same source.
But that's not scientifically, that is not accepted in the scientific as a valid comparison.
She never said, actually she never testified to that. There was no Frye hearing. Appellant didn't file a motion to try to exclude on Frye or anything. All we had was appellant, and appellant didn't present any evidence, more importantly, that says that this was scientifically invalid. What she said is that it was simply put, it was a different level. It is much like the partial DNA profile. Yeah, we can't give you a full DNA profile, but we can give you a partial one. Is that relevant? Sure, it's relevant because at least partially it seems consistent with the DNA. Here, we can't say that we know it's a match to his hair, but we can say that they're similar. And because they're similar, it could be his. Might it not be his? Sure. But might it be? Yes. What's essentially to say that because it might not have a sufficient weight, it's not admissible, isn't really the standard. I don't think that the witness said that there was no scientific value in making this partial limited comparison. She said it was a limited comparison. I don't know that if it was that the defense counsel actually never pressed her that hard on it or said but I think that. That the evidence left the reasonable conclusion for the trial court that yes, it could be considered for this limited purpose of saying that it's a similar hair, and yes, that would be probative evidence that the hair did come from appellant. Was it an absolute match? No. Does evidence have to be an absolute match to be admissible? No.
If we are not persuaded by your argument, what's the prejudice?
You would have to find that the hair was created a real possibility, real probability of a different result trial. That is because of this hair evidence that the court found, that the jury found that appellant committed the murder.
Is it your argument that since he admitted he committed the crime, it couldn't have been prejudicial?
It's not only that he admitted he committed the crime, but into the defense of the trial was that he committed the crime. Nobody contested that he committed murder. All that was contested was whether it was first degree or second degree. Where the defendant admits all that the evidence can ostensibly prove, there can't be prejudice from that.
When
appellant
you say
he admitted it,
what do you mean? I mean, he didn't testify.
You're right.
Counsel admitted.
Yes. Appellant, yeah, I'm sorry.
In the guilt phase, counsel admitted that he committed the acts charged.
Yes.
In argument?
In opening statement and closing argument. Their defense, the sole theory defense for the crime itself was that this was murder in second degree, that yes, he did this, yes, it's horrible, but he panicked, and that this wasn't deliberated.
Why doesn't that make moot the issue of admissibility of the statements on the 7th?
Statements on the 9th.
On the 9th, yes.
Because the statements on the 9th would actually lend to the evidence used to show deliberation.
He might not have admitted at trial had he not already made a confession on the
right,
record.
Right, the confession. Defense counsel was in a position here where there weren't a lot of good theories of the defense because the statement was admissible. So I do think that, I don't think that, and I think the difference between second degree and first degree was statement. I think that the statement still is an issue even with that concession trial.
Is there any further questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
I'm going to sort of jump around, I think, but there's a few points I wanted to hit. If Chief Clark was the type of officer who would, knowing that he's egregiously violating somebody's rights on the 14th, in order to get some other information, whether it's about Spears or Collings, that is relevant back to the 9th because of the type of officer he is. If he's that willing to egregiously violate
rights. And is
rights.
It clear error for the trial court to believe it's not relevant?
Yeah, credibility is always relevant. This was a key
But witness. For the trial court to find it didn't affect his ultimate determination of Clark's credibility. I mean, you're saying, did the trial court, in your view, have to, as a matter of law, find that this destroyed Clark's credibility? Because that's almost what you're asking us to find.
I don't think, as a matter of law, the court had to make that finding. But, I mean, the court should have considered it. The court should have taken into her factoring.
Well, if in reading what the court said he doesn't find it relevant to the purpose of the offer of proof, that he didn't find it affected the it didn't operate to affect the voluntariness of the statements on the 9th. It was language like that. I mean, but that's subject to two interpretations, one of which is that he just didn't find it persuasive on negating the credibility of what Clark said and therefore wasn't relevant to voluntariness. Not that he didn't legally think he could consider it if he had found it relevant.
Well, I think that if the court was finding that it was not relevant, the court would have said it's not relevant. The court is saying some pretty specific things initially. I mean, initially she overrules or grants the state's objection to the evidence. She also says that she's not going to admit it for purposes of the proceeding. She's not going to even, I mean, if she was saying, I'm going to admit it, I've considered it, it's not relevant, but she's not even going to admit it for the suppression hearing. I mean, if she's not admitting it, she's not considering it. She specifically states she's rejecting it, and she specifically states that she believes that it's not part of the totality of the circumstances, that don't look at totality of circumstances when you have a later statement and an earlier statement.
What's wrong about that conclusion? I mean, assume this instead of 5 days down the road, it was 50 days down the road. Okay. How does that change the legal conclusion, if that's what it really is?
Because if it's relevant to the court's consideration of whether that statement is voluntary, and credibility is always relevant, it should be considered.
But what you said is that you're looking at it as a legal finding, and that the judge said it's not relevant to the totality of the circumstances,
right.
Okay? So I understand that statement, the totality of the circumstances, to include a time frame of events that occurred. That's what I hear my brain says when I hear that phrase. Well,
right. So you're asking
at some point in time, how far down the road are we? Mm-hmm. I mean, you're saying 5 days is not so far that it shouldn't be included into the totality, but what about 10, 15, 50? What's wrong with the conclusion that something that happened 5 days later is not relevant to the totality of the circumstances, meaning the factors that went into whether or not the ninth statement was knowingly and voluntarily given?
Because we have no evidence to suggest that the nature of that relationship changed. There's no evidence to say that Clark would have acted any differently. And courts, I cite several.
So you're saying if the statement was given 50 days later, because of the nature of their relationship, that still affects the totality of the circumstances?
Well, 50 days, there might be intervening factors. There might be things that could hypothetically change the nature of that relationship. But within that 5-day span, I don't see how that is so far remote. And I cite cases in my brief, one from the U.S. Supreme Court, one from the Seventh Circuit, where it talks about using post-statement evidence, and it is valid to use post-statement evidence if it's relevant, and it certainly was relevant because it went to the heart of Clark's credibility, which was already challenged because we have discrepancies about the 3 o'clock timing, where all of a sudden he writes in his report it's at 3 o'clock. The Miranda waiver says this statement happened at 3 o'clock. Other officers are saying it happened when they got back from the bridge, and Clark alone is saying no, it happened earlier. The court already had grounds to question his credibility, and this was another factor that the court should have considered. To say that it had no relevance is just kind of mind-boggling to me.
So now we're at it. Post-statement evidence is admissible, right? But now you've got the plain error hurdle.
Yes. And I think it would meet the plain error analysis because it is so clearly and vividly shows what Clark does to pressure and the tactics that he uses, the good old boy, the you don't have you can trust me, I'm acting in your best interests, all that. And I'd ask the court to take a look at the Rettenberger case that I cite in my brief, because it talks about this wasn't a situation where we have an officer who's a friend of, it's not just a run-of-the-mill, like, oh, I sort of know this defendant, so I'll talk to him. This was an extensive relationship, and the Rettenberger case talks about how this type of thing provides an environment in which other interrogation tactics may become coercive. To the extent that the defendant thinks the officers are protecting his best interests, he's less likely to invoke his right to counsel or to remain silent. He's more likely to believe, place more stock in promises or threats. And Clark was constantly telling him, I'm acting in your best interests. I've always been there for you. I'm the one you came to for help.
Should we have an additional disclosure as opposed to what you say may be used against you, that you understand I'm trying to execute you or put you away for life? Now, that's the fact. Now, I'm talking to you because I'm trying to execute you or put you away for life. Now, forward with your statement.
I think that because there was this relationship and because the state has to prove that he's giving his statement knowingly and voluntarily, that the state has a heightened duty to make sure that the defendant knows. You're not talking to a friend. You're talking to a law enforcement.
Is there a case that says it's improper interrogation to say it's going to be in your best interest to talk, come on, take my advice and confess? Or are there cases that say that's improper interrogation? As opposed to lying and saying, I'm going to keep it quiet, I'm not going to pass it on, I'm just here as a friend, but simply encouraging him to tell the truth?
In this case, what he was doing was not true. It couldn't possibly have been in his best interest to confess to murder. With counsel. He talks him out of speaking with counsel and says, okay, you don't need that. It's in your best interest to talk to me, to tell me what
happened. Was that improper? Has that ever been found improper by a court?
Depending on the nature of the relationship, if you look at, there's the Spano case. I cite a few other cases, a Ray Wood case out of the Western District. Usually the false friend tactic is used in conjunction with other tactics.
You're saying it would affect the credibility, should have been used to affect the credibility of Chief Clark. How did Chief Clark's description of the November 9th conversation differ from your client's description? Was it only on when the Miranda warning was given, or were there other important discrepancies that you think this should have been used to resolve against Chief Clark's?
Well, the defense was trying to show that Chief Clark was exerting all this pressure and was making Collings, using the false friend tactic.
And did Chief Clark say, I never said I was a friend and he should confess?
He said, I treated him the same as everybody else. I'm friendly with everybody. I didn't treat him any differently than I would treat anybody. And yet when you look at the November 14th video, it's hard to believe that he could have that type of relationship with everybody in his precinct or community.
Is he an elected judge? Is he an elected sheriff?
I believe so. He's the chief of police. So I'm not sure how that works, Your Honor.
Have you ever been to Wheatley?
No, I haven't.
You know what the population is?
I imagine it's very small. But
is there any further questions?
No.
Thank you, counsel. The matter will be taken under advisement.